The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us on this edition. Follow us at danproftshow.com, where you can get podcasts of the program. And on social media, at Dan Proft Show, we begin with President Trump's announcement that Operation Legend, named after a four-year-old boy who was murdered in Kansas City, is being expanded to include, but not be limited to, Chicago. And by that, federal agents, federal law enforcement, being dispatched to major cities in America to do things like provide added protection to federal buildings, as we've seen in Portland with the attempts at arson, federal courthouse there, in addition to helping where desired and where able, local law enforcement with the interdiction of violent criminals, drug smugglers that are related to the violent criminals, in addition to constituting them and the like. This, of course, has been criticized by socialist mayors in big cities, as well as race-hustling politicians at the federal level, as a gambit into authoritarianism. Tyranny is a word that's been used. Dictatorship. Dispatching federal law enforcement to enforce federal laws in communities where state and localities refuse to enforce state and local laws. That's what a dictatorship, or is that what a free society that respects the rule of law is? It's interesting, the redefinition of dictatorship by, well, aspiring despots, the left's projection. President Trump making the announcement generally about Operation Legend and his approach to keeping the peace on the streets of major urban centers in America.
My first duty as president is to protect the American people. And today I'm taking action to fulfill that sacred obligation. In recent weeks, there's been a radical movement to defund, dismantle, and dissolve our police departments. Extreme politicians have joined this anti-police crusade and relentlessly vilified our law enforcement heroes. To look at it from any standpoint, the effort to shut down policing in their own communities has led to a shocking explosion of shootings, killings, murders, and heinous crimes of violence. This bloodshed must end. This bloodshed will end.
And by the way, it's not just in the big cities that are getting the most ink and the most TV time. It's also mid-sized urban areas like Kansas City, Operation Legend, where there have been 106 murders in Kansas City so far this year after 150 last year. So a significant increase in violent crime there. Lawlessness doesn't know boundaries when it's encouraged. And President Trump had a special guest at his announcement yesterday. That is the mom of that four-year-old boy I mentioned, Legend. Her name is Sharon Powell. She was there, as was Legend's dad, as was Legend's grandparents. President Trump introduced her.
The operation in Chicago will be done as part of Operation Legend, which was recently launched in Kansas City, Missouri, and very successfully, I might add. It is named after Legend Taliaferro, a four-year-old boy who's shot, think of this, he was shot and killed last month while he lay asleep in his home. Legend's mother grieves our hearts and pains and souls, and we thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And here's Legend's mom.
Good afternoon. I am Sharon Powell. I am Legend Taliaferro's mother. I want to thank God for giving me the strength to withstand today. Operation Legend is not to harass, It's not to harm or to hurt. It is to help investigate unsolved murders, in which one of those happened to be our innocent 4-year-old son. This operation is personal to us. We want justice for our son and others. We have to take a stand in our communities and speak up to help this operation be successful. My one and only child who fought through open heart surgery at 4 months is gone due to senseless gun violence. Children are supposed to be our future, and our 4-year-old son didn't make it to kindergarten. I stand here today as a mother fighting against violence for my son, Legend Talaferro. My family and I support Operation Legend, and we strongly want our community and everyone else behind us. Thank you so much, you guys. I appreciate all the efforts.
Mm-hmm. And this is not to offer carte blanche to federal law enforcement any more than carte blanche is offered to local law enforcement. This isn't to excuse any incident of excessive force used by a federal law enforcement officer, as no excuse would be given to excessive force by a local law enforcement officer. So all of the histrionics about dictatorships and camo and people being pulled off the streets, to the extent there is a documentable evidence of any bad behavior by a federal officer, well, that should be reckoned. Nobody's sanctioning that any more than sanctioning bad behavior by, again, a municipal police officer. So what's behind all the hysterics? I mean, there's no constitutional question here. The president has independent authority, not just authority, a constitutional mandate to ensure that the laws be faithfully executed. Take out your pocket constitution and go to Article 2, Section 3. Maybe give one to a mayor near you. As Andy McCarthy points out, enforcing federal law is an independent obligation of the chief executive. They don't have to wait for a state to ask for or grant permission for federal intervention to enforce federal law. So what's the controversy here? In addition to the fact that federal law enforcement, ATF, DEA, FBI, working with state and local law enforcement, hardly unprecedented. It happens all the time and should, because they have powers as well as scope of knowledge that often local law enforcement doesn't have. They can enhance the overall effort to, say, remove predators from the streets of big cities, interdict drug smugglers and human traffickers. I thought that's what we wanted after 9/11, more coordination and collaboration between the various levels of law enforcement, so the right hand knows what the left hand's doing when it comes to everything from stopping terrorist activity to addressing the lawlessness and violence that's wrought on the streets of America's cities by drug cartels. And yet now it's in controversy. Why? Well, because President Trump is Trump. Why? Because we're 100 days from an election. And what America is seeing on the streets of Chicago and Kansas City and St. Louis and Portland and Seattle, they don't like. And you don't have to be a Trump supporter to not like it. You just have to be somebody who doesn't believe we should turn over our society to vandals, these Clockwork Orange bands of misfits who are doing nothing other than committing acts of violence or trying to incite acts of violence. Yes, yes, the peaceful protesters notwithstanding. Everybody knows who we're talking about. I'm sick of having to spend time qualifying. Oh, but the peaceful protesters. The peaceful protesters is a straw man argument. Nobody's arguing about that. We're arguing about this this contingent of violent offenders that are trying to get federal or local law enforcement to lose their cool. Just one officer for just one moment makes one error in judgment and hurts somebody or worse, then they can martyr that person, use that as an example of law enforcement writ large, law enforcement run amok, and demagogue the issue and incite more violence to just burn everything down, because all they're looking for is the destruction. They're not looking to build anything. They're not looking to, quote unquote, reform anything. They're looking to destroy. These are people that have a mindless and seemingly bottomless hatred for America, hatred for civilization, hatred for freedom. They're thugs, thugs with a certain sense of entitlement. And so you find out when even you try to Neville Chamberlain them as Ted Wheeler did in Portland. Ted Wheeler's big solidarity play with the Antifa anarchists in Portland went about as well as Jacob Fries did with Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis a few weeks back.
Black Lives Matter! Ted Wheeler! Ted Wheeler, hey! Ted Wheeler! Ted Wheeler! Ted Wheeler!
Ted Wheeler, who has alternatively blamed Trump and local police for escalating the violence in Portland, which has gone on for nearly 60 nights uninterrupted, is treated to F you, Ted Wheeler. You're a fascist. Don't let him speak, Ted Wheeler. How you like your buddies, Ted Wheeler? You think they won't come for you? You pathetic, appeasing pee hat. This is Dan Proft.
At danproftshow.com.
Welcome back. I just wanted to close out some more commentary on Operation Legend, as well as Chicago violence and the race hustling that's being done in the face of what the president has proposed. Before we get to a story about the purge, that's, you're going to want to hear. Again, the idea that you don't think the purge and the Jacobins will come for you. There's a couple of professionals, an orthodontist and a Morgan Stanley investment manager who would beg to differ. But first, so Operation Legend, dispatching federal law enforcement agents to cities like Chicago, Kansas City, others, Portland. This was the reaction from Bobby Rush, former Black Panther turned congressman from Chicago.
Trump wants to instigate a race war. He wants to have black folks fighting white folks so he can rise up and say, I'm the real grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and I'm the president. Reelect me. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to play to the fears.
Bobby Rush saying Trump wants to start a race war, pit white people against black people, and announce that he's the real grand wizard of the KKK as well as the president of the United States. Yeah, seriously, that's what Bobby Rush said. A congressman representing the south side of Chicago, which has long been a war zone and long been relatively desolate when it comes to economic opportunity. But it's not Bobby Rush's fault. No, no, no. What's happening? Don't look at what's happened in Bobby Rush's congressional district over the last two decades. And don't look at what's happening in it today. All you need to know is that Trump is a aspiring KKK grand wizard. And Joe Biden, similar vein.
In going his spreading of racism, the way he deals with people based on the color of their skin, their national origin, where they're from, is absolutely sickening. Yes. No sitting president has ever done this. Never, never, never. No Republican president has done this. No Democratic president. We've had racists, and they've existed. They've tried to get elected president. He's the first one that has.
First racist to get elected president. One, I, of course, reject the premise. Two is that's just ahistorical. Joe Biden, you may want to confer with your statue decapitating constituents about previous presidents who they don't want to see statuized, memorialized in any way anymore because they were slave owners. Your own party has removed like their Andrew Jackson dinners from the circuit as denounced Woodrow Wilson showing screening Birth of a Nation in the White House. FDR for not inviting Jesse Owens to the White House after the 36 Olympics. But okay, whatever you say. Here's what they're actually serious about. They're seriously concerned that Trump is going to obtain a percentage of the vote of black Americans that eliminates the possibility of victory for Joe Biden and Democrats. And don't just believe me. Don't believe little old me. Believe CNN. They're signaling an alarm. Joe Biden's advantage over Trump with black voters is currently smaller than Hillary Clinton's was. It's still massive, of course. But Trump just needs to improve a little bit over his 2016 performance to create a big problem for Democrats. And they know that. They know that. We're going to talk to Deontay Johnson next hour about this, who's one of the voices, Black Voices for Trump advisory board members. So, you know, where Biden has a 75-point margin among black voters with Trump, a look at pre-election polls since 64, the average Democrat has earned 86% to the average Republican, 60%. That's an 80-point margin. And I've seen polling with Trump getting anywhere from 6% to 16%. Boy, you split the difference. And if he got 11% of the black vote, it would be over for Joe Biden and the Democrats. And, you know, there's every indication that that's a possibility. Based on the record, it should be a possibility. Trump, in response to some of those silly comments yesterday, pointing out criminal justice reform and the Opportunity Zone legislation he signed that was authored by Senator Tim Scott, as well as where black unemployment was prior to the reaction to the pandemic, which is the lowest in recorded history. So those are the credentials he'll run on. And you can call me whatever name you want. Here's what I've actually done. So you're going to judge me on what I've done or what who they're saying I am, despite many of those same people being at least collegial, if not friendly to me during my entire adult life up until the time I decided to run for president. In fact, many of those people receiving campaign contributions from me until I decided to run for president. Right. So that's actually what's going on. And that's what you need to read through in terms of the Rush and Biden rhetoric and the same rhetoric that you'll hear from others. Don't look at what's happening in big cities in America. Don't hold us accountable for the suffering that is disproportionately visited upon black families in places like Chicago or Kansas City. Don't pay attention to that. All you need to know is that Trump is a racist. That's all you need to know. And stick with us because we're not racists. That's the sum total of the market position, as far as I can tell, because there's not much of an evidentiary case that's presented. Not even presented, much less persuasive. Oh, by the way, to give you a little bit of flavor of what Chicago is like for black, white, Latino, Asian alike, this local story that you probably won't bubble up to the national level because it didn't involve a death, thankfully, but it gives you a sense of the landscape. I can't believe we survived. Those are the words of an Uber driver telling his story about how a large group of teenagers attacked his car in the Loop, which is the city center, a few days ago. Group of teenagers getting group of teenagers attacked his car. I said, oh, blank. They came and jumped on the car, started dancing on top of the hood. They tried to open the doors and then they broke the driver's window. And that's where I knew I knew we were in big trouble because they were trying to grab me. And I heard the rear window shatter as well. He told the CBS affiliate in Chicago, the group of teens actually had a pitchfork, which came within inches of his two terrified passengers. Who knows what would have happened if they were able to pull us out of the vehicle? It seemed like they wanted blood. It's terrifying just to think that there's basically a school of piranhas just roaming the streets of Chicago, and we don't know where they're going to show up. The driver said he had to jump to the curb, then go the wrong way down a street in the city center on the sidewalk just to escape the group. He said it's going to take a while to regain the trust of the city, I guess. The driver was uninjured, though his car had more than $8,000 in damage. Going to take a while to regain the trust of the city, I guess. Yeah, I guess. I guess. That's your Democrat socialist governance of your big cities in America. Cover for the violent anarchists. Make excuses for them. And dismiss the concerns of the law-abiding, if not prosecute them straight away, as happened in St. Louis, which we'll get to a little bit later in the hour. And we'll try and get to this purge story I mentioned. If not today, then tomorrow.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show. This is a fun piece from a bunch of Harvard School of Public Health academics. President Trump recently took to Twitter to demand the country's schools reopen in the fall. He framed the conversation as one that pits fear-mongering Democrats opposed to in-person schooling against Republicans committed to reopening the economy. As public health professionals and parents of school-aged children, we urge the country, ignore Trump. Okay, ignore him on reopening. He's also threatened to withhold federal funding of schools that don't reopen in some substantial way. So they say ignore Trump. And then these Harvard public health professors go on to walk through the science, which is exactly what proponents of reopening the schools have been doing. And the Venn diagram of proponents of reopening and Trump supporters is almost a perfect circle. But OK, Harvard, doing our homework to get the kids back to school. Listen to the American Academy of Pediatrics, which argued for focusing on science and not politics and supporting a return to in-person schooling. Multiple studies show that children are not only less likely to become seriously ill, they're also half as likely to get infected in the first place. Listen to the science. What about the risk to teachers and staff? Again, listen to the science. A report led by the former head of CDC concluded children appear less likely than adults to transmit to others, though the evidence is still limited and preliminary. Finally, what about the impacts on community as a whole? Studies show that social distancing measures have been critical to flattening the curve, but school closures may be the least effective of those measures. And they go on to say, we're not saying school as usual. You know, you need all these risk reduction strategies and so on and so forth. But the conclusion, reopening schools should not be an us versus them argument. It's not about them versus Republican. It's about our children and about the evidence. We should be following the science that says in-person schooling for our kids is too valuable to give up. The risk assessment they make that they run cover for the Democrat governors who refuse to make. It's just a remarkable piece. The arguments that we're making, lead with the science, run counter to the arguments that people protesting that they are men and women of science and data, the Cuomos and the Pritzkers and the Whitmers and the Newsoms and the Murphys, run counter to the arguments they're making to keep schools closed down, but we're supposed to ignore President Trump. Because I guess he doesn't speak in the parlance of the Harvard public health professor. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Bethany Mandel. She's the editor at Ricochet, columnist at the Jewish Daily Forward, contributor to the New York Post, and co-host of the Ricochet.com podcast, That Sethany Show. Bethany, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I know you recently wrote a piece about the school pods I saw in the Washington Examiner. But just first on the Harvard public school professionals taking the same position as President Trump, even though they want to distance themselves from Trump, and other advocates both in the medical and public health communities, as well as Republican governors who say kids should be back in school in person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the issue has become unnecessarily politicized. There was a great segment on MSNBC a couple days ago with five pediatricians,
right,
and the host asked them a simple question: would you send your kids back to school? And all five pediatricians unequivocally, immediately said yes. The science is pretty clear.
Right, but the op-ed columnists are not, and so who is being catered to?
I mean, how many of these op-ed columnists have kids?
Well,
that's my question.
Yeah, that's a good question. But I mean, for example, Joel Mathis writing in The Week, some Republicans are so desperate for the coronavirus pandemic not to be a thing that the party's leading elected officials are proving themselves ready, willing, and able to gamble with the health of America's children, their teachers, and families. That's the argument you get, the fear-mongering argument you get in response to all of the science that we just went through with Harvard public health professors. And yet, if you take that position, then you get demagogued by left-wing op-ed columnists.
Yeah. I mean, I have been getting it nonstop because I've been pretty strongly in favor of school reopenings, and I've had a lot of left-wing, mostly childless, op-ed columnist saying that I'm trying to send every American child to their death, when it, like, maybe 30 children have died of COVID. The vast majority of them had very, very serious underlying health complications. This is, the data is pretty clear, and it's really disgusting that so many left-leaning political commentators have decided to turn the future of America's youth into a political football. This is no joke. If they close schools next year, there are millions of kids that won't ever get kindergarten back. And the learning that happens in kindergarten and first grade, and the number of children who are trapped in homes without mandated reporters watching what's going on. The number of child abuse reports has plummeted, and that's not a good thing. There's a lot of dangers out there for kids, but they're all related to the fact that schools are not reopened.
When we come back, I want to pick up on that and talk a little bit more about some of those dangers. More with Bethany Mandel, editor at Ricochet.com, contributor to the New York Post. Right after.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. Well, we're speaking with Bethany Mandel, editor at Ricochet.com, columnist for the Jewish Daily Forward, contributor to the New York Post, and co-host of the Ricochet.com podcast, That's Stephanie's Show. We're talking about some of the dangers to kids for not reopening schools that are exacerbated by not reopening schools. Jason Whitlock, sports columnist for Outkick.com over there with Clay Travis, who's been writing a lot on the intersection between sports and politics and public health issues, has a good piece about this. Can't Breathe is Making It Impossible for Kids to Live, referring to, of course, the George Floyd utterance and the response and how the pandemic's been folded into that. He writes, fear-based decision-making is destroying the future of our youth. We can't keep kids locked in homes, socially distanced indefinitely. The delay in potential cancellation of fall sports will have a devastating impact on young people, and that's already happened in California, football postponed to January at least. He writes, the year 2020 is a nationwide Hurricane Katrina, and the poor will once again pay a disproportionate price for the politically driven decisions of elites. And he knows what he speaks. He talks about growing up, living with his dad in a 400 square foot one bedroom apartment on the east side of Indianapolis. He writes, we were poor. Delinquent taxes forced the closure of my dad's tavern. My dad earned $300 a week plus tips working as a bartender for a friend, and that was in 1984. And he goes on, obviously, he's an African-American. He doesn't diminish the life of George Floyd or victims of police brutality. But he goes on to say, look, I couldn't imagine what my life would be like now had a global health crisis wiped out my senior year of high school, or had I been trapped inside that tiny apartment for months on end with my dad. This is a serious thing. And it's a serious thing that disproportionately impacts people with the least amount of resources and the least amount of options. And that seems to be lost in this discussion, too, Bethany.
Breaks my heart. My next-door neighbor has been learning golf her entire childhood with the hopes of getting a golf scholarship. And they're African-American, and this was a huge challenge for them to break into golf, which is a pretty white sport. And they did it because they wanted to get her competing at a level where she could get a full ride somewhere. And she is competing at a level where she can get a full ride, but now she can't get any auditions. She can't possibly get a scholarship because they're not recruiting. And this is her entire college career and everything she's worked for her entire life up in flames. It's because sports are not coming back. It's literally not a game. It is her future, and it's a very calculated decision that her family made to get her through college, and now it might not.
And you talk about parents that are trying to be a little bit more nimble than some of their centrally planned school districts, these school pods or these sort of co-ops where parents are coming together in clusters and either relying on the expertise of parents in the group with respect to particular disciplines, particular areas of study, or cobbling resources together to bring in experts and teachers to educate children while this back and forth or uncertainty really in so many school districts persists.
Yeah, yeah, and it's great that parents are doing that, but it's going to create a huge disparity between the kids who have parents who are working to make this happen and the kids who don't. And as you spoke to earlier, it's the lower class kids who have two working parents who don't have the time to put together a pod. These are the kids that are going to be left home alone and getting into trouble and not learning. So it's great that it's going to provide a great education, whoever putting together pods, but it's going to really increase the gulf of achievement between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and it seems to me, the comparing what's happening at the collegiate level in some places to the K through 12 level, where it's one size fits all, and if one teacher doesn't want to go back, then no teacher shall go back. And compare that to, say, Georgetown, where professors have the option to teach in person or to do remote instruction, and different people, different professors are making different decisions. But at the K through 12 level, particularly in the big urban centers, it's all for one and one for all, and you layer on that some of the ridiculous demands that teachers unions are making to go back that have nothing to do with safety, that have nothing to do with COVID, that have nothing to do with education, have everything to do with, for sort of national politics. You would think that would undermine the credibility of teachers unions among parents, particularly those, again, that have the least options for the education of their children.
Yeah, and I'm seeing that just anecdotally among my friends who have kids in schools. They're furious that they're watching their kids' education be held hostage by politics and by games. And I'm seeing a lot of frustration from teachers too. There's kind of like, there's a lot of fear, but there's also a lot of frustration that they're undermining their own cause by making these absolutely ridiculous and unnecessary. Demands, because they see that they have hostage. They have the whole school system hostage in a way that they never have and they never will again. And they're trying to take advantage of it. And people see that.
And what's your assessment of sort of these hybrid plans that's trying to make Solomonic decisions about closing versus opening, 2 days with 1 day of remote and conferences, so on and so forth? It seems to me that's still insufficient, particularly based on the risk assessment, as was made by those Harvard public health professors we described earlier in the conversation. But in New York City, they've advanced a hybrid form. And as somebody with school age kids, I wonder what you think about that.
I mean, I think it's crazy. The whole goal, I think, should be to limit kids' exposure to other people and to keep the social circle small, the pods. And so when you're doing 2 days in, 2 days out, when kids are not in school, they're going to be exposed to childcare centers. They're going to be exposed to other kids. They're going to be exposed to babysitters, grandparents. It's widening the network that they have direct contact with. And if kids were in school every single day with all the same people, that creates a pod. And if families and teachers practice social distancing outside of school, that's safer for public health than opening schools.
Closing
schools.
Right. And I mean, it does strike me as arbitrary when you have Mayor de Blasio announcing we'll provide daycare for 100,000 kids. Well,
right.
Okay, so you're going to provide daycare for them, but you won't allow them in school. So it's okay for them to be together every day just as long as they're not being educated. What sense does that make?
Right, and that's the unions. That's 100% the unions.
She is Bethany Mandel, editor at Ricochet.com, columnist at the Jewish Daily Forward, contributor to the New York Post, and co-host of the Ricochet.com podcast, That Sethany Show. Bethany, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Oh, Sheila, let me love you to
the moment. The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. As we were discussing earlier in the hour, Big City America 2020 is where mayors do listening tours with violent anarchists destroying private property, or worse. And let me add now, while a couple who protected their private property without incident is arrested, not only arrested, but it turns out, and I had no idea, that former Stalin head of the secret police, Lavrenty Beria, is apparently the circuit attorney in St. Louis, or at least his, one of his acolyte of Beria's approach to policing and law enforcement. You know, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. That's what Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner is doing in St. Louis with respect to the McCloskeys, this couple that defended their property from trespassers during a Black Lives Matter protest without incident, some jawboning back and forth between he and his wife and some of the protesters. But that was the extent of it. Charges have been filed. Missouri Attorney General has interceded to argue that the charges should be dismissed. The governor of Missouri has said if they are convicted, he will pardon them. But is there even a case here? There's even a case with respect to the Castle Doctrine, yes, and protecting private property from trespassers. There is no case here. That's what many law professors who've weighed in on this have said. I would agree. But in addition to that, what the circuit attorney's office is doing to try to maintain a case, manufacturing evidence. Here's the latest wrinkle. The assistant circuit attorney ordered crime lab staff members to field strip the handgun that was brandished by Patricia McCloskey, found it had been assembled incorrectly. Specifically, the firing pin spring was put in front of the firing pin, which was backward, and made the gun incapable of firing, according to documents filed with the court. That's a problem because charging them for, you know, unlawful use of a weapon, it is necessary to prove that the weapon was readily capable of lethal use. The firearms experts for the circuit attorney's office then put the gun back together in the correct order and test fired it, finding that it worked. But that's a problem because the McCloskeys knew the gun was inoperable. Their attorney, Joel Schwartz, confirmed to a local news outlet in St. Louis the intentionally misplaced the firing pin on the gun and that it was in that condition when she waved it at protesters because they had used the gun as, or the husband, Mark McCloskey, used the handgun as a prop during a lawsuit they once filed against, of all things, a gun manufacturer. Remember, these are Mark McCloskey is a plaintiff's attorney. I don't find him sympathetic at all. In fact, I generally find him detestable. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have private property rights. It doesn't mean he doesn't have Second Amendment rights. It doesn't mean that he isn't protected by the Castle Doctrine. And it doesn't mean that this is a malicious prosecution where you're manufacturing evidence. Prosecutorial misconduct at a minimum. Show me the man and I'll find you the crime. That's the culture in prosecutors' offices in these big cities, politicized prosecutors' offices. This is frightening stuff. I'm Dan Proft.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us at danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. President Trump announcing yesterday the expansion of Operation Legend, starting in Chicago with federal agents being dispatched here to help quell violent crime. Started in Kansas City, Operation Legend did, now Chicago. Portland, we know, of course. And there could be more cities on the hit list as local political leaders allow anarchists to run wild. President Trump explaining his decision.
My first duty as president is to protect the American people. And today I'm taking action to fulfill that sacred obligation. In recent weeks, there's been a radical movement to defund, dismantle, and dissolve our police departments. Extreme politicians have joined this anti-police crusade and relentlessly vilified our law enforcement heroes. To look at it from any standpoint, the effort to shut down policing in their own communities has led to a shocking explosion of shootings, killings, murders, and heinous crimes of violence. This bloodshed must end. This bloodshed will end. Today, I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime. We'll work every single day to restore public safety, protect our nation's children, and bring violent perpetrators to justice. We've been doing it, and you've been seeing what's happening all around the country. We've just started this process, and frankly, we have no choice but to get involved.
Dan Heninger, writing the Wall Street Journal on the topic, offers a useful insight. See if this doesn't describe Chicago in addition to New York and so many other major cities right now. He writes, there's a serious matter of civil order at issue here, but if you look beyond the mayhem, something else quite sad is happening. The irrepressible vitality of these cities, their reason for being, is disappearing, undone by pandemic, lockdowns, and a new culture of permanent protest. For years, Heninger writes, I've been on the email list of Spike Wilner, who's the owner and founder of two jazz clubs in New York's Greenwich Village, Smalls and Mesro. Mr. Wilner's weekly pans to jazz and the people who play it are always a good diverting reading. This week's email, different. Here's a chunk of it because he's got the city actually right. It's hard to describe, but the feeling is gone, the vibe absent. The thing that made New York, New York is missing. What's it like now? It's very tense. People are very anxious and angry. Everything is closed or, if open, listless. There is no light nightlife. If you leave your apartment after 9 p.m., it's a complete ghost town inhabited by wraiths and zombies, dangerous people. In certain parts of town, you have a mob of folks partying outside like a street fair. Other folks keep their masks tightly on and live in fear. The only place I found some civility and warmth is the city playgrounds where I take my daughter each day. The children are oblivious to the pandemic and just play and climb. That jazz club owner, Spike Wilner, is describing Chicago, too. That's the Chicago I see.
Oh, yeah.
Open but listless. No nightlife. People living in fear. Town mainly inhabited by wraiths and zombies. Dangerous people. Pandemic, lockdowns, new culture of permanent protest. Do you want that to become a feature of American life or just an unfortunate episode? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Tom Homan, the former acting director of ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is also targeted for defunding by the left. Tom, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how did you react to the president's decision? And it's, a surprisingly difficult one. People make it look like, some people make it sound like, oh, it's an easy call for the president to do this because he wants to recreate Nixon in 68. But you could go either way on this. You could say, hey, Portland doesn't want federal law enforcement's help, then good luck, Portland. But he chose not to do that because he believes that as the president of the United States, he has a responsibility to enforce federal laws, even if the localities don't want to enforce state and local laws.
Well, absolutely. I agree with him 100% for doing this. And Article 2 of the Constitution makes it clear it's not only he has the authority to do this, he has a responsibility to do this. So once again, President Trump is showing American people that he's putting the safety and security of Americans first. And, you know, in the media, I listened to, you know, Speaker of the House and a lot of the media saying Trump's sending troops. You know, he's not sending troops. He's sending federal law enforcement officers. These people, first of all, people remember these cities, Chicago, Portland. There's already federal law enforcement in those cities. That's why they have a federal courthouse because, you know, a lot of federal prosecutions happen in those cities. He just increased the amount of these, surging these officers there. And they're highly trained. And I just wrote an op-ed on FoxNews.com and just posted this morning on this very topic. And I want people to know these aren't, you know, as some people are calling thugs and stormtroopers, these are very well-trained federal agents and very well-trained in the Fourth Amendment, arrest, seizure, what they need. You know, they know what people's rights are. They know what their responsibilities are. And they're going to do a great job. This is the first time they've been deployed out to cities. They've been deployed out to cities many times. Way back in the race riots are deployed. So this is nothing new. This president is doing exactly what the American people expect him to do. He's doing exactly what an American president should do.
Too many illegal guns on the streets. We have to go after the guns. And it would seem to me, okay, well, what about the people in this country illegally that are part of international drug smuggling operations that have guns illegally? Why wouldn't you want to use federal law enforcement? Why wouldn't you want to collaborate with federal law enforcement on the immigration piece to remove people here illegally who are trafficking in drugs illegally, who are using illegal guns illegally? You know, it's very selective, their concern about who has guns illegally and who's committing violent crimes.
You know, if I was the mayor of Chicago and I have the crime rate you have there and the gun violence you have there, I would take all the help offered me. That is her responsibility to protect the taxpayers of Chicago. And I'll repeat myself. She is not doing everything she can to protect the citizens of Chicago. It's out of control. The whole country can see it. And President Trump is going to help those people that need help. If the mayor refuses to do it and the governor refuses to do it, the president is going to go in there and he's going to help the American people. That's his job. And we all support him on it. In New York City, the same thing. And another shout is that when they get, like, let's say New York City, they get New York City and they're arrested by a federal agent for federal crime. The feds don't care about the bail reform law in New York. It means nothing to them. They're not going to be booked into a jail to immediately be turned around and let loose because of bail reform law in New York. They're going to be locked up in front of a facility until they see a judge. So there's a big difference. The consequence and deterrence of a federal agent making an arrest and charging with a federal crime is a lot more serious than some of the local charges.
You've also looked at Vice President Biden's proposals and his pronouncements on illegal immigration, and you suggest that what Biden has said is music to the ears of anyone wanting to come to the U.S. illegally and to the criminal cartels that can operate, that can and will expand their organizations, I should say. Why do you say that? What did Biden say?
Well, look, I've been enforcing immigration law for 34 years, but it doesn't take an expert on immigration law in the border to understand what Biden did. Biden's done three things. Anybody can look it up. Anybody go to his website, his campaign website, and read it. One, he says the first day in office, he's going to put a moratorium on all deportations. Second thing he said, it's when they start to deport people, they will only deport those in the country illegally that have committed and been convicted of a serious felony. Third thing he says is illegal immigrants should get free medical care. The best medical care in the world, we won't give it to you. Those things alone. It doesn't take a genius to realize what that's going to the border. If he sent a message to the rest of the world, it's okay to enter this country illegally in violation of law. It's okay to commit a crime of illegal entry. It's okay to work here illegally. It's okay to displace an American worker. It's even okay for you to commit crimes. Just make sure it's not a significant felony, and you're never going to be deported. If that's not an enticement for people to come to this country illegally, now, I've never heard of one. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to realize all the success President Trump has made on this border in the last 3 years is going to go away quickly.
Tom Homan, former acting director of ICE. Tom, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks for having me.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Part of President Trump's presentation of the expansion of Operation Legend, named after a four-year-old boy who was murdered in Kansas City. President Trump talked yesterday about introducing federal law enforcement agents into cities that are having problems with violent crime and are seemingly not very effective in addressing them, if they're even trying to be. The president singled out Chicago, for obvious reasons, as the Wall Street Journal termed Chicago, It's Murder City, USA.
For this reason, today, I am announcing that the Department of Justice will immediately surge federal law enforcement to the city of Chicago. The FBI, ATF, DEA, U.S. Marshals Service, and Homeland Security will together be sending hundreds of skilled law enforcement officers to Chicago to help drive down violent crime. And murderers and violent criminals are breaking a wide range of federal laws. We have that. It's as wide as it can be. We will find them, arrest them, and prosecute them. They will be in jail for many years to come. And we will work with local police to identify violations of state and local laws to help ensure that offenders are caught and jailed for their crimes. But we must remember that the job of policing a neighborhood falls on the shoulders of local elected leadership. Never forget that. When they abdicate their duty, the results are catastrophic. Americans must hold their city leaders accountable. They must insist that community officials fully support, fully back, and fully fund their local police departments. There is simply no substitute for a police department that has the strong backing of city leaders.
And then we heard from legend Taliaferro's mom, who was present at this announcement. Her name is Sharon Powell. Legend's father was also there, as were his grandparents. And, you know, Chicago is getting a lot of the headlines, Portland and Seattle, because of the images coming out of those cities, the autonomous zones and the other silliness. But Kansas City, where Ms. Powell and her family hail, from where they hail, 106 murders so far this year, 150 all of last year. So they're seeing the spike in violent crime is happening in mid-size urban centers, too, like Kansas City, and it can't be forgotten. And Ms. Powell certainly wants to make sure that Legend's death isn't.
Good afternoon. I am Sharon Powell. I am Legend Taliaferro's mother. I want to thank God for giving me the strength to withstand today. Operation Legend is not to harass, it's not to harm or to hurt. It is to help investigate unsolved murders, in which one of those happened to be our innocent four-year-old son. This operation is personal to us. We want justice for our son and others. We have to take a stand in our communities and speak up to help this operation be successful. My one and only child, who fought through open heart surgery at 4 months, is gone due to senseless gun violence. Children are supposed to be our future, and our four-year-old son didn't make it to kindergarten. I stand here today as a mother fighting against violence for my son, Legend Taliaferro. My family and I support Operation Legend, and we strongly want our community and everyone else behind us. Thank you so much, you guys. I appreciate all the efforts.
And in Chicago, what is Mayor Triple Threat's response? To provide the encouraging news that more resources, law enforcement resources, are on the way to protect families, particularly in the south and west sides of Chicago, where the majority of the violent crime is occurring. To announce, as Trump did yesterday, there's $61 million in grants that the federal government is providing for us to hire more police officers, and we're going to try and take advantage of those resources to hire more police officers, to protect those who need more protection, to protect those families, frankly, who we are failing at present, failing in our fundamental responsibility to provide for their physical protection. We're failing them. Federal government's providing resources so we can stop failing them as a city. That's good news. Is that what Lori Lightfoot said? No. This is her main concern.
He will be at the helm supervising these new resources that will be coming in to our city. So they're not federal troops. They're FBI, DEA, ATF.
U.S. Attorney John Lausch will be supervising the federal agents, law enforcement agents coming in. So you don't have to worry about federal troops. You don't have to worry about the dictatorship that she said was imposed on Portland from D.C. The tyranny she warned about. Federal law enforcement coming in to enforce federal law. That's what Lori Lightfoot calls the auspices of tyranny. That's her response. Make sure you're not worried about federal law enforcement rather than focus on how we shouldn't be worried about violent criminals and their predatory behavior in Chicago's neighborhoods against innocent victims, like the almost two dozen kids under the age of 18 who've been murdered in the last 5 weekends. It's just remarkable. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Deontay Johnson. He is the president of Black Conservative Foundation. He's also a Chicago native. And as he tweeted out earlier in the week on the occasion of that shootout at the funeral in the Auburn Gresham neighborhood on the south side where 15 people were shot, that shooting occurred down the street from his grandfather's house. Deontay Johnson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. You're a Black Conservative Federation, so that means you're a Black Conservative. See how I figured that out. Black Voices for Trump Advisory Board member, and as I said, a Chicago native. So how do you receive what President Trump had to say, the rollout of Operation Legend so far, and then the reaction he's getting from mayors from Lightfoot in Chicago to Wheeler in Portland?
You know, this is great news. This is really great, good news. This shows what our president is. Our president is a solutionist. And, you know, he made a commitment to America on putting America first. He made also made the commitment of making sure that America will be safe again. And that is exactly what we're seeing, a safer America. And so, you know, Chicago's a part of America, whether Lori Lightfoot likes it or not. And our president is making sure that Chicago is safe, that the black community is safe, that people can go outside and be able to go to the grocery store in peace, to be able to just have a walk in the park in peace and not have to worry about gun violence in the neighborhood, you know. And so he's providing us peace of mind, and that's why we love our president, because he is definitely putting America first.
Now, I know you went to U of I. Where'd you go to high school?
Went to high school. So actually, I moved out of Chicago.
Oh, you did before.
Into Danville, Illinois. And so Illinois, and that's how I ended up at University of Illinois near Champaign.
Deontay, let's hold it there. And when we come back, I want to get more insight as to your childhood in Chicago. More with Deontay Johnson, president of the Black Conservative Federation, when we return.
The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
We're back with Deontay Johnson. And before the break, we're talking about your time growing up in Chicago. And give us more texture to that and what you took away from growing up here, as you remembered as a young man, not that long ago, and how you have seen a change even through the eyes of family and friends in the present.
Yeah, that area. And then my grandmother lived in the Roseland community. And so I remember being a kid in Chicago and actually being able to play outside. That was when there was still violence happening, but the violence was happening in a, I don't want to say a secured area, but, you know, those happened in the alleys and behind closed doors and a lot of times late at night. Nowadays, it's just happening in the plain daylight in front of them, out in the open. And that's where the problem is.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you're a young man. You're still in your 20s, aren't you?
Yeah.
So when you're talking about being a kid, that's not that long ago. And you're describing an environment that's very different than the environment we're seeing in Chicago right now. And so what do you think the difference is?
There's a differencing of parenting. Growing up, I saw the making of what we're seeing today, because the people who are doing the shooting, a lot of them aren't even over 30. But what I saw was a lot of parents taking up for their children, where there's a problem, the parent will go and they will have at it with the teacher. And what that did was that caused students and their children not to be able to have any sense of accountability. That's what we saw, is that people were not accountable. And what happened is that they said, well, I can do whatever I want to do because my parents are going to take up for me. And that went from the school age to high school to now in the real world. And so that's a big problem that we're having right now with our gun violence and our violence in general, that there's no one who's taking ownership. There's no accountability. No one is holding these people accountable. And to be honest, those who are doing these shootings, a lot of them are living in, still living in their parents' basement or their grandparents' basement.
Mm-hmm. And then the officials, both locally at the state level, at the federal level, at least those who represent, for example, the city of Chicago, represent Portland, represent Seattle, other major cities, New York City. It seems to me they're mostly interested in pandering to Black Lives Matter for votes than they are in addressing any of the problems you're describing.
Yeah. You know, and Gianno Caldwell, Fox News analyst, I heard him say multiple times is Black lives don't matter to Democrats. Black votes do. And that's all. That's all that they're worried about now, because it's amazing how, if you notice, Black Lives Matter was pretty quiet between when President Trump first got elected and now. There was some movement here and there, but there hasn't been much movement. There hasn't been much happening. And now that we're close to election, it's time to start ramping up fear again. It's time to start causing ruckus again.
So as somebody involved with Black Voices for Trump, I mean, do you see, we see this, even there was a piece in CNN about Trump doing incrementally better with the Black vote than he did 4 years ago at this time against Hillary Clinton. And I've seen polling that suggests he may do substantially better, and substantially isn't a big move. It could be go from, 6% to 11%. And that could be a real difference maker. And how ironic would that be if the Black vote puts President Trump over the top in November? But do you see that happening as you travel around, as you talk in your cohort of young Black men and women? Do you see more movement or more open mindedness to Trump, particularly against the backdrop of this violence?
Absolutely. And I'm one of the youngest. On the advisory board. But I will tell you this, is that the Black vote is up for grabs, and we are coming after it. We're coming after it, and we're going to get it. And we're going to get it. And President Trump has made it so easy with the policies. We talk about opportunity zones. We talk about what he's done for HBCUs. We talk about the lowest unemployment rate amongst African-Americans and women prior to coronavirus. We talk about criminal justice reform, which was a big one that really resonated with Americans all over. When we talk about the Chicago area, criminal justice reform and opportunity zones was something that was important, because it's taking communities like the Roseland community, like the Inglewood community, and giving opportunities for growth for those communities, giving opportunities for those communities to now have access to Whole Foods and have access to healthy eating and have an access to revamped housing. That is one thing that I love about President Trump, because he, in 2016, he said, "What the heck do you have to lose?" And 2017, once he got elected, he immediately went to work on making sure that he repaired all those areas, schools, neighborhoods, and communities.
Deontay Johnson, president of the Black Conservative Federation, Black Voices for Trump advisory board member, and Chicago native. Deontay, thanks for joining us.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. Moving from our discussions of practical notions of law and order in modern society, let's go to the philosophical underpinnings of a free and modern society. And whether or not the purge should not just go back to the founding of America, not even go back to 1619, but go back to 300 BC and pick up or pick off Aristotle, as the case may be. To help us with that question and topic, We're pleased to be joined by Agnes Callard. She is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago and the author of Aspiration, The Agency of Becoming. Ooh, agency. Agency. I like that word. We'll discuss it. Professor Callard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You ask and answer the question in a recent op-ed in the New York Times, should we cancel Aristotle? You point to Aristotle's defense of slavery, his inegalitarianism, as you term it. But you stop short of saying that he should be eliminated from consideration in pursuit of competing notions of how society should be ordered and what a life well lived entails. Well, why should Aristotle be spared in our culture today?
In a way, I was picking Aristotle because he's a kind of worst case scenario. Aristotle's kind of at an extreme, and yet no one has proposed canceling him.
Not yet.
I'm not defending him against cancellation from a crowd of people wanting to cancel him. And I think it's very telling. What it shows is that cancellation is not really about the content of what people are saying. If it were, Aristotle would have been first in line. So I'm sort of using him as an example to illustrate what motivates cancellation.
I don't know. Do they still teach Aristotelian ethics in higher ed? Maybe people are just not unfamiliar with him, those leading the purging of all of these scholars and philosophers and political leaders from a bygone era or a bygone epoch, as the case may be.
He is taught, I would say, in every philosophy department in this country. His place in philosophy hasn't been diminished in any way, nor has anyone suggested that it be.
So then develop more. You talk about treating Aristotle as an alien in terms of assessing his value in a discussion about competing schools of thought about the life well lived, for example, or about ethics. Treating him like an alien, what do you mean?
I think we could think of the way that we interact with him as sort of along the lines of the way that we would interact with an alien. Namely, we don't take him to be embedded in our current sort of political struggles. He's kind of not party to this war that we're having. And so it's really when someone is a participant in that war that their speech becomes, as I say in the piece, sort of magnetically attracted into messaging. So he's an outsider. That's sort of what I mean by treating him like an alien. He's an outsider to our dispute.
I thought you made an interesting point. You wrote, in a highly charged political climate, more and more speech becomes magnetically attracted into messaging. And the difference between speech and messaging, the distinction you make, is an important one. One can hardly say anything without arousing suspicion that one is making a move in the game when they may call for a counter move. So develop that a little bit more for us, because I think you're onto something really important that I haven't heard quite put in those terms.
So my thought is that sometimes when someone says something, you hear like a subtext or a message in it where you think that in some sense they're using their words to push you around and you have to fight back. And that's hearing them non-literally. And they might be actually doing that, right? You might be correct to hear them non-literally. But I think that, you know, in a charged political climate like we're in, that it becomes really hard to speak without people getting suspicious of you in the sense of thinking that the literal content of what you're saying is just the tip of the iceberg. And what lies beneath the iceberg is a kind of force that you're trying to exert on them.
Mm-hmm. And you also write like Aristotle, you're a philosopher. And we as philosophers must countenance the possibility of radical disagreement on the most fundamental questions. Well, that seems to be a very controversial position in our culture today, particularly on campus. And not only to me, it seems most fundamental, radical disagreement on fundamental questions, but also assessing people in terms of the substance of their ideas, even if they engaged in some really terrible conduct. I mean, in other words, I don't know, it comes to mind. Heidegger. I mean, how can you can you address Heidegger's philosophical contributions without waving him off, without dismissing him out of the hand because he joined the Nazi Party? Should we listen to Wagnerian operas because there was again a dalliance with Nazism there? You can say those were huge mistakes, and that was an awful thing, and that was a terrible misjudgment on their parts, or even that they were bad people. But can't you and aren't you compelled to still address their ideas because of the importance of their ideas during that time period and how it shaped our understanding of different schools of philosophy?
Good. So I think there are two distinct issues here, right? So one of them is the question of how radical the disagreement is, right? That is, how much does the content of the person's views, say, differ from yours, the person that you're engaging with? And there, for instance, Aristotle is way further from us than Heidegger, right? So we disagree way more radically with Aristotle for some of the reasons that I give. But that's one question. The other question is, like, does your ability to engage with their views, irrespective of how radically you disagree with them, depend on, say, how they behaved in their lives, the immoral actions they performed, right? And that's not really about how radically do you disagree, at least on the content of the views, right? It's more like, do you disapprove of them as a person?
Right.
And when does your moral disapproval of someone as a person influence your ability to interact with them on the content of their views? And I think that's, you know, and that gets to the whole question about, you know, removal of statues and, you know, does even engaging with someone in some sense glorify them or, right, that's that kind of debate. And that's somewhat tangential to the question, but, you know, which contents can we engage with, right? And how extreme can the content difference? That's more of an extreme, so to speak, personal difference. That's what gives rise to messaging. And there, I think, you know, it matters a lot whether we see the issue as a live issue. Like right now, racial tensions are an extremely live issue for us. You know, Nazism less so, and Aristotle on slavery way less so, right? And that's going to shape who we feel free to engage with and how free we feel to engage with them.
When we come back with Professor Agnes Kellert, I want to pick up on the issue of separating the substance of people's ideas from their behavior. More with Agnes Kellert from University of Chicago when we return. Would you rescue me? Would you get my back? Would you take my car when it starts to crack? Would you rescue me?
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with philosophy professor Agnes Kellert from the University of Chicago, and I want to pick up on parameters of discourse are sort of contingent on the radicalness of the disagreement. That may be a description of the landscape at present on, say, college campus, but is that a prescription for what the limits of the conversation should be? That seems to me something that's a bit arbitrary and also a bit limiting. Why can't I engage, again, anybody who's run afoul of whatever the salient issues are of the day, race relations, anybody who is, George Wallace, an advocate of Jim Crow, and what George Wallace meant in context of the civil rights movement and so on and so forth. John Lewis, who just passed away, who forgave George Wallace and the idea of reconciliation in that context. Am I allowed to even bring up George Wallace in the context of John Lewis's passing and the idea of reconciliation as a conversation piece in race relations? You know what I'm saying? I mean, things are so interconnected, and you start saying, well, this is out of bounds and this isn't because it's not as salient as it needs to be. Who decides that?
Right. So I really was just giving a descriptive claim, right?
Okay.
But
a lot of people aren't.
Let me say one thing, which is we might imagine an extreme position would say, I always just engage with the content of the person's views in every context and just set aside any wrongs that they've done. I don't think anyone, literally anyone, has that position. And one way to illustrate it is just think about a personal fight that you're in with someone. Think about, like, someone you love just did something terrible. And then they're like, okay, but I want to discuss this. And you're just like, I can't talk to you right now. Like, you're like, well, just listen. No, I can't talk to you. We all do that, right? That's just a human thing. We can't repudiate that kind of response on a general universal level. So the question is, where do we draw the line, right?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you don't have to draw the line. You just fold it in. So, yeah, Heidegger had a dalliance with Nazism, and you can fold that into the conversation. What's wrong with that?
Well, it might be fine, like, in some contexts, and it might not be in others. I guess my view is that once you grant that the extreme position, which is that someone's transgressions are never in any way relevant to how you might respond to the content of what you say. That's an extreme. It's an interesting position. I'd love to see someone defend it. I've never seen anyone defend it. But defending that position would require the person is going to be consistent, also defending it in your personal life and how you respond to people. And I've never seen anyone who is like that. That would so to speak, be an alien of a different kind. And so the question is, of course you can, you know, once tempers have calmed down, you can be like, well, look, let's take a step back. Heidegger did some bad things, but he said some interesting things. That's definitely my approach to Heidegger. But the question is, can I kind of litigate and prescribe that approach to Heidegger for everyone at all times in history, including, you know, my grandmother, who was a concentration camp survivor? I don't think I can do that for her. I think she kind of has to figure that out. So my view is a line has to be drawn, but it has to be drawn in quite particular ways in different cases. So I'm not willing to, so to speak, come down and tell you right now exactly what is the line universally for all time. There can't be a universal line for some of the reasons that I've been giving.
Agnes Callard, she's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago. She's also the author of Aspiration, The Agency of Becoming. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Recently, I interviewed Eric Felton over at realclearinvestigations.com. And this is with respect to recent notes that were released last week Friday by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Notes on Christopher Steele that relate to Christopher Steele and his sources for his dossier. It is stunning. Just when you think this can't get more absurd, the Steele dossier turns out to be something like a parody of a Tom Clancy novel, with primary subsources and subsources to the subsource that are basically like a friend circle of people that have no particular information, at least at the outset, of anything Trump-related, who don't even know who the players are. They, you know, names are relayed, and then they can't remember what names they're relayed, but they're supposed to be giving value-added information on people like Paul Manafort. Who? What was that name again? And then interactions are completely invented, I mean, in terms of the credentials. For example, one source identified as Source E is described in the Steele dossier as a Russian close associate of Republican U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump, who admitted there was a well-developed conspiracy of cooperation between them, Trump world, and the Russian leadership. That close associate was a disembodied voice of a guy that Christopher Steele didn't even know. And this is how he characterizes him. So when you've heard earlier reports about how this was all fiction, and you heard even members of Congress who were privy to some of this information before the public was, which is months and months and months ago, this is what they're talking about when they say this whole thing was invented. So if it was all invented, if this doesn't pass the laugh test for a grade schooler, then how could the FBI continue to run with it, willfully suspend disbelief, and continue to run with this as the basis to continue their counterintelligence investigation and their surveillance program? Holman Jenkins argues over at the Journal, why? Well, FBI Director Comey had a powerful interest in changing the subject away from his chaotic actions in the Hillary Clinton email case. Actions so chaotic he was even rebuked by then-Attorney General Loretta Lynch. Maybe that's part of the why. For more on this, the what as well as the why, we're pleased to be joined again by John Solomon, award-winning investigative journalist and founder of Just the News, justthenews.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure joining.
So I know you wrote about another specific aspect of this, which is the FBI wanting to use White House briefings to spy on Trump and Trump aides as part of their rolling counter-intel investigation. But first, if you would, just address Eric Felton's piece and those notes that formed the basis of his piece, that just how ridiculous the Steele dossier was, and so just how untenable the position is that there was any basis for this investigation, the surveillance warrants, and everything else that ensued over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's amazing. So these notes that came out Friday, I wrote about a year and a half ago, and there were two consecutive stories that I wrote. And the first was that in January 7th, on or around January 7th, the primary subsource was interviewed by the FBI, and he renounced most of what was being attributed to him in the dossier by Christopher Steele. When the FBI does a check on the source and they find out that the people he's claiming to, quote, deny what they're saying or claim that was a joke or that's not accurately what I said, you shut down the informant. You don't keep going on with the investigation. Then there was a second part of this that gets lost, but when you put them together, you just realize how big a farce the Steele dossier was. The FBI created a spreadsheet starting in November of 2016. Now, they should have started it before they submitted the first FISA warrant to the court in April, but they got, in October, but they finally got to it. And they started evaluating every sentence in all the memos that made up the dossier. And 90% of the sentences they concluded were either erroneous, repudiated by the sources they interviewed, never able to be confirmed, despite all the incredible tools of the U.S. government, or internet rumors that you could have found with a Google search that were obviously not intelligent. 90%. When you take those two things together, you realize for one full year, on four separate occasions, the FBI went to the FISA court and said, we have a right to violate Carter Page's civil rights and to spy on the Trump campaign because we have this dossier and it's verified and we have no derogatory information because this guy Steele's a solid guy. You now realize that there was a knowing and willful criminal attempt to mislead the FISA court. It's not accidental. These are not accidental things that happen.
Well, and the other thing, too, so Comey, in his classic, you know, cover his ass way, you know, recounts how he goes to Trump at this briefing and says there's this dossier now. It's unverified. We're still looking into it. Well, he knew or had to know, based on the quality of the information, as you're describing, that this thing was a joke from the beginning. But he was using it not only to put on the FISA court, but also to put on and perhaps, you know, keep Trump at abeyance for his position, that there's this thing that I'm looking at and it's uncertain, but I just wanted to apprise you that it exists and I'll keep you updated.
And then what happens? 3 days later, it's leaked to the media. And what's so interesting about the FBI's conduct, I put a timetable together. You find out January 4th that the FBI want, 2017, that the FBI wanted to close down the Mike Flynn investigation, the career people who do the job by the book, because there's no derogatory information. Within 7 days, there's a leak of the Flynn transcript to the media to make it look like something bad had happened. On January 5th, the president is told, there's nothing there, boss. This is we just want you to know about it. And what? On January 9th, a BuzzFeed gets the leak of the dossier. There is a repeated pattern. Every time they came to a stop point in the investigation, where under the law and under ethics, they should have shut it down. Instead, they leaked something sensational to try to keep the public going and wanting to get Trump investigated. This is really dirty stuff. This is what the FBI should not be doing. It's what they should be prosecuting other people for doing. The Comey FBI will go down as one of the most crooked and incompetent FBIs in recent history.
Do you believe, I mean, since you've been ahead of the learning curve on all of this from the outset, do you believe that it will get to the upper reaches, the Comey level, the Brennan level, and not just functionaries who doctored evidence and so forth, but it actually gets to the leadership level in terms of any criminal prosecutions?
That's a great question. What Attorney General Barr just said a couple of weeks ago in an interview is that the people that are under criminal investigation are very familiar names. Well, Kevin Kleinsmith, the lawyer that allegedly doctored that, he's not a well-known name.
Right.
So I think Barr is hinting at some of the bigger level people. I would guess that from the reporting that I've done, it looks like they're looking at John Brennan for some testimony issues and his conduct related to the Intelligence Committee assessment that claimed Russia was trying to help Trump and hurt Hillary. That seems to be in doubt now. And I think they're looking at McCabe and Strzok and maybe Comey, but McCabe, Strzok, and that crowd for possibly hijacking the FISA in a way that misled the court. But, you know, it's hard to tell when things go before grand jury, when it's behind closed doors. John Durham is not a leaker, unlike the Comey FBI. There was no leaking out of this investigation. So you're at the mercy of defense lawyers and witnesses. And I think we just got to wait and see. But there is a prima facie case of criminality sitting in the public record right now that,
should give us all pause, and we should all hope that the Justice Department gets its act together and some people indicted.
And do you agree with Holman Jenkins that perhaps the why did this all unfurl the way that it did, was initially for Comey to, again, cover his backside with respect to how he handled the Hillary Clinton email case, and then it just took on a life of its own?
I think Comey's willingness to accept the case in October with the flaws probably had a lot to do with guilt, because he's still suffering from the boomerang of the eating. I think when you get into January 17, the FBI has a different motive. Mike Flynn and Donald Trump are going to blow up the intelligence community. They had a different way. They wanted to do business as the new sheriff in town. And the FBI and the intelligence community establishment wanted to resist that. They wanted the status quo. And I think a lot of this is bureaucrats trying to preserve their own status quo. And it just takes on a life of its own that becomes, quite frankly, criminal. But remember, in my book, it all starts with a different motive. Hillary Clinton knows that this Clinton cash allegations against her. She does a poll. 53% secretly tell her that voters tell her that the biggest reason they may not vote for her in 2016 is that they think that she engaged in cashing in on her policy issues when over Russia, when Bill Clinton got the big donations and the speech fee and the foundation was getting all of this thing. So this starts out as a dirty trick to neutralize a problem that Hillary Clinton sees in her polling data. And you just think of that this started as a political neutralization effort that becomes a political dirty trick that then becomes a wayward FBI investigation. It's a perfect storm. You couldn't write a novel that would be more interesting or more unlikely than what really occurred here.
He is John Solomon, award-winning investigative journalist, founder of Just the News, justthenews.com. That's a must-read site on a daily basis for just this kind of insight and reporting, frankly, doing what the D.C. Press Corps won't do. John Solomon, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the show. And boy, our next guest, per a piece he wrote on a missive from a Princeton philosopher from a few decades ago, could have been folded in nicely to our conversation with John Solomon from justthenews.com about the Russian collusion matter, the absurdity, and how much more absurd it becomes with each new tranche of information that's released, as we discussed earlier in the week with Eric Felton. And the piece in question, or at bar, which is certainly a conversation for our time, is a essay by Princeton philosopher Harry Frankfurt entitled On, and so I keep my FCC license here, On Bull Jive. And it's the difference between a bull jiver and a liar. Not a distinction without a difference, a distinction with a difference. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research and part economist, part philosopher, which I think you have to be a good one of either. He is Joachim Buch. Joachim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And so this is a fun one. The difference between a bull jiver and a liar, and why that's important, that difference is important.
Yeah, it's very tricky, right? Like, a liar intentionally cares about the truth. Like, this sounds a bit counterintuitive, but they want to conceal it. Like, if I lie to you, then I'm telling you something that's not true. So I really care about what is true because I want to conceal from you what is true.
Yeah.
But if I'm a bull jiver, then I don't care. I'm just saying things. I will just say something that will get the result that I'm looking for. And then I can play, you know, virtue signaling cards. I can enrage you over something that I want you to be upset about. I can do all kinds of things, but I'm not caring about the truth. And so I end up in this very weird situation where I am saying something deceptively and I'm deceiving you. And you think that we're playing the truth game, but we're not playing the truth game all the time. Sometimes we're just like using words.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. It sort of dovetails with a conversation we had last hour with Agnes Callard, who is a philosophy professor at the University of Chicago, about messaging. Now, we're not having a conversation. I'm messaging to try to sell one market position or one brand. And perhaps if you're receiving it right, and then you're messaging back to me to try to sell or advance a different market position or a different brand. And so, for example, one that is timely, Joe Biden yesterday saying that President Trump is the first racist president of the United States. Now, that is, I would call that bull jive because, one, I mean, it's just demonstrably true and everybody would understand it. All you have to do is look at what the protests are protesting, in part, that we have had presidents who were slaveholders. We had a president who screened Birth of a Nation in the White House, Woodrow Wilson. We had a president who interned Japanese Americans. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that that's not true, even if you think Trump is a racist. And then there's the additional argument that there's not a lot of evidence to support that Trump is a racist based on, for example, his record as president. But that's a statement where Joe Biden is just trying to drive a market position, just trying to drive a brand on President Trump, regardless of the truth of Trump the president or the history of American presidents.
It comes up a lot in politics all the time. I mean, it's the nature of politics. Whatever you think about politics in general, this is how the game works. Ultimately, then it kind of gets weird because a lot of people who watch this and a lot of people who, like, you know, honestly, genuinely want to believe in political decision making in this way, they think it's a truth game, but it's not a truth game. Like you say, Joe Biden just says something demonstrably untrue. Nobody cares. And everyone gets upset because, you know, Trump is a racist. It's like, okay, fine. You can think that's not the point, but he's clearly not the first racist president in the history of the U.S.
Well, right. And you use the case of the environmentalist movement, too. And I think you'd have a lot of agreement with you, including some longtime environmental activists that have recently spoken up and written books on the topic of how much misinformation is spread, including Michael Schellenberger and Bjorn Lomborg. And the point there again is it seems to come from this attitude where I have the morally superior position. So the truth isn't important as the ends are. And if using some bull jive as the means to those ends is necessary, then it's necessary because that's the morally superior end.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. And it's such an interesting thing that I've been really confused about in the last few years. The environmental movement is, on the one hand, right, like whatever you think about the topics, on the one hand, it's like they're honestly and clearly exaggerating things. Like there's no doubt about it. There's so much exaggeration. There's so much poorly used statistics and things that are generally not true and exaggerations all the way through. But there is also this case like, well, maybe they should be allowed. Maybe this topic is so important, right, that they should be allowed to exaggerate a little bit so that you can scare us into action. Like we think about this a lot when it comes to, say, world poverty or like donating to charities or whatever. Charities are not, you know, accurately portraying reality for us to give money. They're showing the worst outcome, you know, like the worst possible thing.
Right.
So that sort of shocks us into action. And it's the same thing going on here with a lot of the environmental claims that go around, like Extinction Rebellion in the UK or, you know, the Green New Deal. And it's been a big political thing in the US. Like they just say things that are so, you know, outrageously untrue. You know, we're all going to die in 12 years or whatever the topic was. Like, this is clearly not the case. Like, no scientist is saying this, but for some reason they get it on their they get it into their heads that they have to like shock people and say the worst possible things and give children nightmares just so that, you know, we can have slightly better environmental policies. Like, it's nonsensical to me. Like, start playing the truth game instead and tell us, you know, what happened.
Well, right. I mean, it's the infantilization of a free people, if you live in a free country or something approximating it, by those in elite positions. And it's dangerous. And we see this playing out with COVID-19, too, don't we?
Oh, a lot. Like COVID has been one massive, what's the word you use? Bull jive. So jive show, basically, with so many. I think it's people just saying things. Like this morning, literally this morning, I read an account from Public Health England that apparently somebody who died in a car accident had tested for COVID-19 and was then counted as a COVID-19 casualty. Like clearly, like come on, guys, this is not like this is just insane. And the same like exaggeration stuff is going on. Like we can't see anybody, we can't like meet people. Testing is outrageous. We have to shut down society. We have to shut down everything because there's this disease that kills elderly people. Like the risks for me, like I'm below the age of 30. The risks for me from being harmed from COVID-19 is smaller than, you know, a normal commute for most people, you know, like it's just out of this world, crazy. But yet everyone's like super, super serious. And we have to like deal with this as if it's an actual chaos, an actual disaster. Yeah. And there's something going on here. And like you say, like, you know, we jump from these different topics and it's happening in so many places. I remember Barry Weiss from New York Times in the letter she wrote when she resigned just now last week or something. She said the same thing. It's like the prevailing notion at the New York Times is that it's not to inform, you know, smart, clever, serious readers about the world or, you know, what's going on. Or showing different perspectives from by different people. It's, you know, the enlightened few professing the knowledge to the masses.
Yeah.
This is insane.
The bull jive game to political ends versus the truth game. I this is great that you brought this epistle forward for reconsideration, because I think it's a great conversation in the modern context. He is Joachim Buch. He's visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research. Joachim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Secretary Steve Mnuchin saying this morning on CNBC that the payroll tax cut measure will not be in the legislation, the coronavirus relief legislation that Senate Republicans release. It won't be in the base bill, he said. There will be a continuation of enhanced jobless benefits, but it will not be at the $600 per week level, ideally to incentivize people to go back to work where there are job opportunities available, and there are. In addition to that, $105 billion in new funding for schools and universities, giving state and local governments more flexibility in using existing federal aid without offering them any new money amid calls for sending another round of $1,200 stimulus checks to American households. Yeah, so even as the stock market continues to chug along, the hits keep coming when it pertains to the reopening of America, reopening of American schools, the revitalization of the American economy. For more on the public health side of this, we're pleased to be joined again by physician and molecular biologist, Dr. Henry Miller. He's a senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute and was the founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. And he writes in a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal, "The sad truth is that we are still in the early days of this pandemic." Dr. Miller, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Dan.
So if we're still in the early days of this pandemic, and I don't dispute that, I'll defer to your expertise on that, then what is the approach that we should be taking? What's the philosophical approach we should be taking, the first principles that should guide our decision-making with an eye towards this extending beyond perhaps a vaccine, perhaps not a vaccine, perhaps another year, perhaps many years? How should we be approaching this?
The mantra should still be flattening the curve. We need to intervene in ways that decrease the number of infections, the degree of utilization of hospital beds and ICUs, and keep the death rate down. And we seem to have lost track of that with premature reopening in states like Florida, Texas, and Arizona. And now we're reaping the whirlwind. This was totally predictable. You know, that states like New Jersey and New York, which made mistakes early on but learned from them, have improved their situation immeasurably.
Well, New York and New Jersey still account for almost half of all deaths in the country. In point of fact, I think it's New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts account for 10% of the population and nearly 45% of all deaths. So they may have a lower positivity rate at present, but the catastrophic decisions that were made by all of those governors, most notably reintroducing the infected into long-term care facilities, still puts them as the worst example in managing this based on death as compared to even those states which arguably opened up earlier than they might have otherwise, like Texas and Florida and Arizona.
They were egregious mistakes early on, but they learned from them and now are on the road to extensive reopening and returning kids to school and so on, whereas some of these other states are not. they're at the wrong end of the curve. They're getting worse, not better.
You know, again, looking at the Florida, just as one example, I mean, we see data that there have been something on the order of 265,000 new cases in Florida since June. 100,000 of those are over the age of 45. 165,000 of those are under the age of 45, and the fatality rate for the under 45 is something like 0.04%, which is, you know, about one-fourth. Actually, it's about 1/40th the fatality rate of those over the age of 45 in that 100,000 case cohort. So, I mean, the median age, the incidence of hospitalization, the length of hospital stay, the changes in terms of who's getting infected matters too, doesn't it?
It does. But what is something that we seldom consider is that fatalities, death rates, are not the whole story. This is not a trivial illness. And the number of infections is very important because there are very frequently lingering side effects that are long lasting. An Italian study showed that 87.5% of patients who recover from the acute effects of COVID-19 go on to have more symptoms that persist. They found that after 2 months following the acute phase, about 55% of patients experienced fatigue, about 44% shortness of breath, 26% joint pain. And some of these people are so debilitated that they can barely walk up a flight of stairs.
Let's hold it there. When we come back, I want to pick up this discussion about what we've learned, and particularly in the context of protecting those who are vulnerable, trying to flatten the curve, as you say, and whether or not we're implementing what we've learned. More with Dr. Henry Miller, physician and molecular biologist, senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. Right after this.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Henry Miller, physician, molecular biologist, senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute, and the founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. And we were talking before the break about what we've learned as we've observed the disease and we've called through some of the numbers as compared to what the models had predicted. And I wonder, Dr. Miller, if we've learned a way to do something short of a complete lockdown like we did initially and you know, just sort of being confined to the phases that were originally set up prospectively, even if those phases don't make as much sense retrospectively to be implemented again. And so, for example, when it comes to going back to school, sending the kids back to school, can't we not have a paradigm whereby school districts offer flexibility to those who are in vulnerable cohorts while getting the kids back to school because of our understanding of how poorly remote learning went in the spring semester, the end of the spring semester, how much damage could be inflicted upon kids with a continued isolation, remote learning, lack of socialization and intellectual development, as per the American Academy of Pediatrics and other such looks at this. Have we learned ways to sort of modulate so we're properly assessing risk and then advancing policies that do the best job to advance the interests of Americans, including American kids, while taking you know, reasonable precautions to stop the spread, flatten the curve, as you were saying?
Yeah, that's a very difficult conundrum because it's a balance. We talk about kids being less vulnerable to infection and certainly to serious infection, and that's true unless they have significant comorbidities. So kids with type 1 diabetes or kidney failure or who are being treated for leukemia should probably not be back in school unless the level of infections in the community is pretty low. You also have consideration that kids, although they may not have symptomatic infections as frequently as older people, they do spread the virus with asymptomatic infections. So recent studies have shown that kids over the age of 10 spread as frequently and as vigorously as adults do. So we need to do this prudently. It's going to vary. There needs to be social distancing. There needs to be, I think, masks in kids who are older, and there needs to be testing. Teachers, janitorial staff who are going to be needed in larger numbers to do deep cleaning.
Although, I mean, the study that came out from Swedish and Finnish health agencies over the weekend, I believe, showed severe cases of COVID-19 were very rare among both Swedish and Finnish children aged 1 to 19. No deaths reported. The closure or not closure of schools, since Sweden didn't close and Finland did, had no measurable direct impact. And they also make the point that teachers in both school systems were not infected at a particularly high rate and actually infected at a lower rate than many other professions.
One of the reasons is that the ambient rate of infection in those countries in the community is lower. Why is that? They're complying better with strictures like wearing masks and social distancing in general than in places like Southern California and Florida and Arizona and Texas. So, for example, we've said for a long time that one of the basic tenets of flattening the curve and keeping it flat is contact tracing, testing and contact tracing. You can't do contact tracing when you're having in a state 10,000 infections in a day. It just can't be done. And the reason for that is that there's bad compliance. We're seeing it all over. It's a very difficult balance. One way to do it might be hybrid programs where you have partial distance learning and partial in-person teaching, so that you can have smaller classes and keeping the kids in groups in order to minimize exchange of possible shedding.
The CDC said a couple of weeks ago that, and this was at the time we had about 2.5 million cases, that they expect it's more like 22 million cases that were off by a factor of 10, but 22 infections. It's just only 2.5 million have been identified. And we also have a study that comes out from German public health officials this week that finds T-cell immunity among a study group of about 57,000 was something like 81%, which is not inconsistent with some other studies that put T-cell immunity in the 50 to 60% range. So if we have many more infections, exponentially more infections than we think, and if we have T-cell immunity at a much higher rate than initially anticipated, then don't we get to herd immunity much more quickly than maybe we initially guesstimated?
Most epidemiologists and infectious disease experts think that reaching herd immunity from natural infections is a myth and is purely aspirational. It's probably not going to happen, is the bottom line, for a number of reasons. The antibody titers begin to wane after 2 to 3 months. We don't know how extensive and how potent the T-cell mediated immunity is, but we're going to need a vaccine in order to get herd immunity.
But even with a vaccine, I mean, we still have the incidence of death. I mean, 1 in 5 children who died from influenza in 2018 had been vaccinated. And so, you know, this precedent that we're setting, particularly just going back to school, since I think that's top of mind for families right now, you know, but based on the precedent we're setting now, we would ostensibly argue for school shutdowns or a hybrid program for schooling or remote learning altogether with each flu season, wouldn't we?
COVID is not flu. Flu is very bad for the very young and very old. But COVID doesn't seem to have that same threat to the very young. The flu vaccines are generally on only about 20 to 60% effective. So if we say, if we take 50% as a rough average, only half of those who are immunized are going to be resistant to the flu.
Right.
So, we may do better with COVID-19 vaccines. We hope we will, but we really need to push for as wide immunization as possible. As you know, the anti-vaccine movement is very strong and very well organized and very and largely unconvincible.
He is Dr. Henry Miller, physician, molecular biologist, senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute, and the founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. Dr. Miller, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dr.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. And I promised you a purge story earlier in the program, and here's your purge story. Dateline Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Protest planned at the wharf in Manitowoc after a photo was posted by an orthodontist there local and two other men on a boat in Sturgeon Bay holding a rope tied like a noose with the caption, "It really is a garage door pull." The men were learning how to tie a bowline knot, and it's picture. They've got the picture in the article. If you hold it up like a noose, it could look like that, but it wasn't, and that wasn't the point. And there was, from what I understand, there's no conversations of any racial nature. And then one guy tweets out a smart-ass remark, you know, per the Bubba Wallace controversy, right? He then was subjected to the mob and a protest, as was mentioned in this piece about the incident. The orthodontist apologizing, "I apologize for posting the picture. We were all learning to tie a bowline knot. We were so proud when we could finally do it. Anybody who knows me knows I'm not a racist. I sincerely apologize." You know, that's not going to stop. That's like a waving a red cape in front of the mob. "To our community, I'm sorry unconditionally. Usually when I'm speaking to the public, it's about good things happening that bring us together. I made a terrible mistake. I'm sorry. Apologies not accepted." And then, you know, the Wharf, on their website, the Wharf Manitowoc values inclusivity, equality, blah, blah, blah. They're genuflecting as well, so the purge doesn't come for them. Here's the purge story. So this guy made a smart-ass remark that was probably not terribly thoughtful. However, and there was a protest outside of his business trying to prevent customers from going in and so forth, as I understand it. But I have a good friend who's one of the other guys on the boat who is a money manager for Morgan Stanley. He's just in the picture. He didn't post it on social media. He didn't make the smart ass remark. He's just a guy who is sailing in Manitowoc, right? One guy posted it and then made the comment, but there's other guys there. One of the guys is a money manager for Morgan Stanley. He was fired. He was fired for being in the picture. He just took a picture with a bowline knot with his friend sailing. Some guy, one of the other guys, posts this garage door pull comment that creates this controversy. And now he loses his job. I mean, the guy's going to be fine. He's very successful and so forth. But how insane is that? That is lunacy. Completely innocent. Out for a day of sailing. He takes a picture with friends. One of the friends makes a smart ass comment. It has nothing to do with him. He didn't do anything other than go sailing, and he loses his job over it. That's where this goes. The same thing that happened in a Michigan school district where a popular teacher was fired after he pointed out that Trump is our president on social media. Fired from his job. That's the only way you can get fired as a public school teacher in this country, is say Trump is our president. That is a factual statement, I believe. He is our president. You think the purge is all fun and games, or you think it's just for high profile, or it's just on Twitter, and if I just avoid social media and so forth. This guy avoided social media. Social media didn't avoid him, and he loses his job. That's insane. And that's also reflective of how afraid and thuggish, and some combination of the two, are C-suite executives in big corporations and probably small businesses, a lot of small businesses too. Frightening times. Thank you for joining us on another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Please do so again tomorrow.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.